Chapter 13 of Genesis, please. Genesis 13. If you have trichodecophobia, I'm sorry, but we're going in the 13th chapter. It's chapter 14. Oh, okay.
So I can go to a motel
and
they don't have a
13. Yeah. And everybody, on the 14th floor goes, I know where I am. Okay. We come to the life of Abram here as he and his family are returning from Egypt. Chapter 12, you remember, is the call of Abram and then his sojourning, if you will, into the land of Egypt. And now he turns and goes back into Palestine, Canaan, whatever word you want to use to call that particular territory. And in verse 1, we're told that Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him, into the Negev. By the way, when it says when he went up, that's a Hebrew way of saying he went from a less important place to a more important place, okay? That's kind of how it appears in the Old Testament. You go up to Jerusalem. Now, Jerusalem is up. It's up on a hill. So, yes, theoretically, to get into Jerusalem, you will ascend into the city itself. And many of the Psalms are called ascent psalms because they're about going up to Jerusalem. We're going to be looking at one this Sunday. And the idea is that going up then meant I'm going from a place less important to more important. So Abram's going up to the Negev. And topography-wise, that's true. He's going to a land of higher elevation. Egypt, as you know, sits in actually the Nile River Valley at the port of the Mediterranean there, so it's right at sea level. And so Abram is going back up into the hill country, and he's going up into that spinal column of mountains. You remember I said that runs north and south through the center part of the land. So he's going back to this place. And it appears, as you can see from the end of that verse, that Lot is with him. So this story now will move from just a story about Abram to a story about Abram and Lot. Notice the title is Abraham and Lot Separate, and we'll see another lesson on Lot next week. The or 2 weeks actually, because we don't meet next Friday, but anyways, the point being that Lot is with him. And the assumption then of verse 1 is that Lot has been with Abram in Egypt. Now, there's no mention of Lot in chapter 12. There's no mention of Lot being with Abram while he's in Egypt. And none of the events that are surrounding Abram and Sarah in Egypt mention Lot. But it seems reasonable and logical that Lot would be there, because we know Lot was dependent upon his uncle for his support and for his protection. And when Abram went into the land of Canaan to begin with, he had brought Lot with him. And so as Abram flees the famine in Canaan, it seems highly likely that he would take his nephew with him to that place. Okay, so Lot is with them in that place, and then Lot comes back with them from Canaan. And so the story now focuses on both men. And one of the things that we learn immediately, and Moses is very, I think, specific in including this, is that Abram had become quite wealthy by this point. See, it says that now Abram was very rich, in livestock, in silver, and in gold. Okay, and this connects back to verse 15 and 16 of the previous section. When the princes of Pharaoh saw her, that is Sarah, they praised her to Pharaoh, and the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. And for her sake, he dealt well with Abram, and he had sheep, oxen, male donkeys, male servants, female donkeys, and camels, etc. So in other words, while in Egypt, through the process of his wife being taken by Pharaoh, Abram actually prospered from it. Became a problem for Pharaoh, of course, but it became a blessing, quote unquote, upon Abram. The implication, I think, is that Lot also became wealthy in the process. He prospered as a partner of Abram in a sense. They were together in this. And if you go down to verse 5. And Lot, who went with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents, verse 6, so that the land could not support both of them dwelling together, for their possessions were so great they could not dwell together.
Wow.
Okay, there's a couple of things that I think you come out of that. Number one, Abram and Lot both become wealthy while they're in Egypt. It's possible they brought some of their wealth with them from Haran, but it's more likely that most of it was garnered while they were in Egypt. And it would appear, based on the way that's written, that Lot and Abram had a partnership, if you will. They worked and lived and supported themselves together. They were two men with one set of wealth, nearly. It's probably one of the things you need, I think you need to think about here is it's very real and very possible that Lot and Abram, it's hard to tell where one started and the other began. They were, you know, they were separate and yet cohabiting the same world. Now that makes perfect sense given that they're uncle and nephew. They're blood relatives. They're
like father-son.
Almost like father-son. Yeah. And so, that is necessary to understand how the story flows, particularly as we move into the next lesson having to do with Abram or Lot's reality down in Sodom. Lot and Abram are not just a couple of guys that happen to show up in the same place at the same time. These are two men of like mind. These are two men of like property. These are two men of like realities. And so all that happens to them in the story is connected. So Moses wants us to see that right away. He wants us to have that connected. These are men who are, when Abram says, hey, let's go over here, Lot says, okay, that's where we'll go. So they're doing this, and that's important. It's also, of course, important to recognize that all of this wealth that had been lavished upon Lot and Abram was, of course, by the common grace of God. It was a generosity of God pouring out this common grace upon these two men. There's nothing about Lot that's special, per se, in redemptive history. If you think about it, Lot doesn't have any particular role in the redemptive history story after we get past these few chapters. He disappears.
He's just benefiting from a good uncle.
He's benefiting from the grace of God poured out through an uncle that he's with. The uncle is the one, of course, who is the primary key person in the story. And so Lot is a hanger-on, but there's grace there. There's common grace that's pouring out of the relationship that God has with Abram, because the story is about Abram. The call was upon Abram. The land was given to Abram. Lot is simply a guy in the story connected to him. But that's important for us to remember. The fact is that there's this sense in the New Testament that the gospel of Jesus Christ has an element to it in which we are not only blessed individually in our faith in Christ, that we are blessed with the eternal value of all that, but that grace pours out of us into others. Not in a salvific sense necessarily. Sometimes, yes. Family life, for example, we marry, have children, those children benefit from the salvific grace that we have in that it's poured out from us through our proclamation of the gospel to our kids, and then they grow up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. But there's also the sense in which other people around us, even though they might not come to faith, they benefit from God's grace which extends even through us. And we must remember that, okay? How we treat others around us is a reflection of how that grace has been poured into us. And that's really very important in Lot's life here, because Abram could have said to Lot, get away from me, you know, just go away and I don't have anything to do with you. He doesn't do that. This story is about the close relationship of two men. It doesn't always look like it, but it is. And it'll be particularly relevant when we get to the next lesson.
We probably all experience that where sometimes your coworkers or your friends or whoever, when they're facing something terrible,
yes,
they will come,
yes,
to you.
Correct. Somehow they instinctively know, right? Hey, there's something about this man who prays. Would you pray for me? I don't believe in the God that you're praying to, but would you, you know.
The salt and lightness.
Exactly. Salt and light kind of thing. That's correct. Yep.
Just take that from an individual to the church.
Right. Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Yep.
That's what it is.
There you go.
Grace by association.
Grace by association. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things here is something that also that Abram includes, which mustn't be overlooked. In verse 4, it says that Abram journeyed on from the Negev as far as Bethel. So he went north to the area around Bethel and to a place where he had originally pitched his tent when he first arrived in the land between the cities of Bethel and Ai. When I say cities, I mean these are just sort of small locations on a plain at this point, where he had made an altar at first. So Abram's altar is still there, apparently. And so he goes back to this place, and it says, Abram called upon the name of the Lord. And you remember that this is an important statement in the book of Genesis. We saw it earlier when in the time of Seth, men began to call upon the name of the Lord. There was now a sense in the human condition that they needed God. The fall of Adam and the banishment of the people, the banishment of Adam and Eve, and potentially even their kids, from the garden, was a sense in which God said, get away from me. And the reverse of that, man saying, I don't need you anymore. I'm separated from my God. For my creator, sorry. And so the world is filled with this sense now because of the fall of an utter distinction between God and humanity. There's an utter difference now between man and God. There was a tight-knit and close interpersonal and intimate relationship between the creator and the created in the garden. God walks with Adam, and he has an intimate, tight relationship. And when Adam sins, he goes and hides himself in the bushes. So God banishes him away. And now you have this sense in which man is kind of like, God is up there, and we're down here, and there's a separate world. And you have that picture of it in the Tower of Babel, where you have men building their little empire and don't want anything to do with God. We'll build a big tower so everybody will come to us rather than to God. And then we have the picture of Seth. And men begin to call upon the name of the Lord. And the sense of that is people realizing, wait a minute, we need our creator. We can't do this alone. We can't survive by ourselves. We need him. Now, of course, I understand. The reality is that without the creator, no human being would exist. All God would have to do is say, okay, I've had enough, and all of this creation would simply vanish. God is holding all things together. He's, but there's this sense from our perspective that he's up there, we're down here. And that's what I want you to see here. Abram knows this God in the sense that he's gotten this call. When he gets to Canaan, what does he do? There's a famine in the land. He makes a choice. He goes to Egypt. He takes Lot and his wife and goes there, and he deals with the situation. He makes a logical choice. Let's go down there. When he gets there, he makes more choices that cause himself and Pharaoh trouble. Now he comes back. And guess what he decides? He decides, you know what? I need my creator. I need this God. I need him to guide my steps. Moses, I think, includes that because what you will see from this point on is a new form of wisdom that will rise up in Abram. You will see a man who will now not only be a guy just called to be some sort of, agent of God's redemption, but he will actually become a wise man. It's not that he wasn't wise before, but he will have a different kind of wisdom even, where you will now see him act in ways that are more consistent with his wisdom. Now, I'm not suggesting he's going to act perfectly here, okay? There's going to be some moments where his wisdom escapes him, right? But at the same time, there's this kind of this sense over him that the Creator envelops Abram. And now the story is about Abram and his God, and they're sort of one. And how this goes is in this tight relationship between this man and his Creator.
It's as if he's beginning to worship.
Yeah.
Before a holy God.
Yeah.
You think he could have starved to death. He could have lost his
wife. Right.
Now he's rich. And God just prospers him. Maybe he's gaining recognizing the faithfulness.
Possibly. Although we're going to see that his wealth becomes a problem for him. But, it's reasonable, however, to assume that Abram is not just worshiping. I get that picture. But I like to see it not just as him worshiping his creator, but him actually walking with his creator now, in a sense of his life is an act of worship. His whole existence is it's not just about Abram anymore. It's about Abram and Yahweh as one walking forward from this point. And that, again, is that not a picture of the gospel? This is what happens. We are distinct from our creator. We are separated from our creator by sin. And what happens? The Spirit of God comes, makes us new creatures, indwells us, impermeates us in every aspect of our lives, and we now walk with God in us. That's kind of the picture I want you to see. When you call upon the name of the Lord is this idea of I'm now saying, hey God, I can't do this alone. Would you come? Would you be a part of this? Would you navigate my life for me? Because, you know, I might want to have control of the ship, but every time I grab the wheel, you know, we're in trouble here.
Yeah, he grabbed the wheel and did this debacle with his wife / sister to the Pharaoh, and
mm-hmm.
he's booted out.
Yes.
The commentary says the Pharaoh ended up having more integrity than he gave him.
That's correct.
So,
yeah.
But how humiliating.
That particular one.
And shameful.
Shameful, humiliating.
And I've done,
right.
I've done it where I went, I've done something real stupid like that and go, not again.
Mm-hmm.
I won't be here again. You know?
And I think that's exactly where Lot is at. I don't want to be there again. I want to do what's right. And so help me to do that. Come and be my help. Okay? So as we move into the story then, we see in verse 7, there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. So there's strife because, as we see in verse 6, the land could not support both of them dwelling together. Their possessions were so great that they are literally attempting to graze flocks that are simply too big for the area that they're in. And it's starting to cause strife between the men that are supporting Lot's flocks and those that are supporting Abram's. And at the end of verse 7, Moses puts in this reality that at the time the Canaanites and the Perizzites, I think it's better pronounced Perizzites, are dwelling in the land. There are other peoples here. Okay, there are a lot of other ites, by the way. These are not the only ites around here. We'll see a whole bunch of them as the story unfolds. There's other peoples occupying this land. And here this man and his nephew and his family and his flocks and herds invade this particular territory. Now, you got to put yourself in a second millennium, nearly third millennium BC mindset. This is a time in which men are, the world is I'm not sure I'd like this term, but it's a much more uncivilized place. This is every man for himself kind of world. You survive entirely on what you are able to produce from the ground. There are no supermarkets. There are no central places where you can go and, you know, produce from Chile is being shipped in. That's not happening. This is where you grow the crops in the ground, you keep your flocks going, and you survive, and your family survives entirely on what you're able to make. This is not only an agrarian society, this is an utter agrarian society. There is nothing but farming and agriculture now. And there's no thought even in these people's minds of the idea of cities where you could go and dwell and, you know, the local government would take care of you. There's none of that. None of that even exists in their minds. And so you have a man who shows up with this massive herd, two men, show up with this massive herd, and guess what he's doing? He's invading the territory of others. Which explains, by the way, why he has a guerrilla force. We'll see later, because he's going to need one. So he's coming into a place where he's not only having to deal with the realities on the ground of the fact that this area is not that arid. It has limited grazing land in the first place. If you know about the topography of Israel, you know that the area around Bethel and Ai is at the lower end of the is at the lower side of the hill country. It's moving towards the plains and into the arid areas, but it's nowhere near what it's like down near the Mediterranean. And so you're pushing yourself into a territory where there are others who are not happy to see you there.
Especially with a with a bunch of eaten animals.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you're in competition with the natives here. So this is producing the strife as well. It's adding to the strife. There's probably problems with the herdsmen taking care of Lot's flocks with the neighbors as well as with each other. And so there's a whole lot of problem here. And Abraham sees it and he knows it. And so he, in verse 8, he says, let there be no strife between you and me and between your herdsmen and my herdsmen, for we're kinsmen. We're brothers, you know, we belong together. We're family. All right. So let's do something. All right. Is the, not the whole land before you? Separate yourself from me. If you take the left hand, then I will go to the right. Or if you take the right hand, then I will go to the left. Okay. So he gives to his nephew the first choice as to where to go. Now, I asked the question, did Abram have the right to make the first choice? Why did he have that right? Of course, the answer is obvious, right? He's the right because he's the patriarch. He's the guy that has he's the guy that came here. He could even make an argument, I think. He would say, look, God sent me here. He didn't send you. I'm glad you're here. You're my kinsman, and that's fine. But this is all about me. It's not about you. He could have used all those arguments and said to Lot, I'm choosing the best spot. But he gave the choice to Lot. And I think, I'm pretty confident of this, that Abram knew what kind of man his nephew was. Okay? It's gotta be true that Abram would know at this point what his nephew would choose and why his nephew would make that choice. He knew what kind of a man he was. Lot turns out to be an idiot. And the fact is I suspect that Abram knew that. I mean, he knows the boy. He knows what he's been doing in the past and all the time they're in Egypt and the time they've been here and on the journey and while they were in Haran and how he's been coming up and what he's been thinking. And it would appear that as the story unfolds here, we see that Lot decides to just choose the best place for selfish motives. And so Abram probably knew that. It may very well be here that Abram is testing his nephew. To see what his nephew would do. See what kind of reaction would he have. Now let me ask you another question here that doesn't often get asked. I've never actually seen it asked. How does Lot understand the concept of Yahweh at this point?
You don't hear him calling out to the Lord.
You don't see him calling on the name of the Lord. What is Abram's relationship with this man in terms of how he's communicating about the Creator to Lot? If I'm understanding Abram at all here as the story unfolds, is it possible that Abram is trying to help Lot to understand who God is before he makes rash and stupid decisions? It's very possible that this is all part of Abram attempting to show Lot in the hard way how to understand and come to worship this God. Lot hasn't gotten a call from God. Lot doesn't understand probably a lot of what's going on. Remember, we're talking about a time in which there's no scriptures at all. The Spirit of God is not acting in regenerative way amongst people. The relationship of men to God, as I said earlier, is one of God's up there and we're down here and there's little connection between them. And so we don't really know what kind of understanding of Yahweh that Lot had, I suspect. That this is actually a test more than it is some sort of economic survival matter. It certainly is that. But there's also a test going on here. What will you do? What will you choose? What will be more important to you? Will your wealth be more important to you than me? I mean, is that not what Jesus asks a number of times when rich people come to him and he says it's harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God than it is for a camel to go through the eye of a needle? Go sell all that you have, give it to the poor, and come follow me. You know, what kind of reactions does he get? Because human beings, being in physical nature, have a tendency to focus on that, which is physical. Lot's doing that. So I think this story isn't just about, you know, Abram saying, okay, you pick where you want to go, I'll pick where I want to go, and I could have made the first choice, but I'm going to give it to you. I think it might also be the idea that Abraham is trying to say to Lot, listen to me. We have a God who can guide us in these matters. Go to him and ask him what he'd have you to do.
You can see that. You know, if you've raised up your kids and you raise them up in the way they should go, and there comes a day you release them.
Mm-hmm.
You release them to the world. He's doing that here. I mean, there you go whichever way.
What are you going
to
do here?
And you can almost see that where he's like, I've been trying to train you.
Yes.
And you've even seen my mistakes, but.
There you go. Very well. Very good.
And he goes, I'm going for the good stuff here.
There you go. You were going to say, Wayne?
Well, that line has observed Abram as far as how God has dealt with him, how he's dealt with God.
Correct.
How he has received grace.
There you go.
Upon the Lord.
Yep.
You know, there's been, Lot has had, it's been revealed to
him. Yep. I think so.
And this is almost, you know, by Abram doing this, it's showing him grace in the same way that God has shown Abram grace.
Grace in the sense of, I'm going to let you make a choice,
right.
But I'm going to give you a grace not only to make a choice, but to actually make a good one.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you an opportunity here to call upon the name of the Lord. I'm going to give you an opportunity to build an altar and go ask God, what would you have me to do here? Lot doesn't do that, of course.
I think Abraham at this point, that this reveals something of his character too, in that if he, even knowing, thinking probably how he's going to take the good stuff,
yep.
Get the better,
yep.
I'll be okay.
Well, of course, I think this
you
is,
know, I mean, that's kind of,
Abram is
calling
not,
on the name of the Lord.
There's, I mean, that's exactly what I was going to say. This is exactly Abram calling on the name of the Lord. Lord, would you have me to do? And it's almost as though the Lord tapped him on the shoulder and says, give Lot a choice here. It's okay. I'll take care of you. If he chooses the best spot, I'll take care of you. But I want to work in Lot's life. And I'm not going to work in Lot's life like I worked in yours. I'm not going to make it easy for him. I'm going to put him through some troubles. Watch this. Okay.
The other aspect of this that I guess I never really thought of until we've gone through this is Moses writing this, and the children of Israel hearing this, granted, one, he's trying to give them a connection as far as who they are.
Yeah, yeah.
There's also life lessons.
Of course.
Sure. And I find myself wondering, as Moses is teaching, you know, reading this or mm-hmm. telling this, what's going through their minds?
What's going through their minds? How are they thinking? Now, we're about to go into that land, right? And so let's choose wisely. Let's call upon the name of the Lord. Because we've already got the law in our hands. We've met with God at Sinai, and we know He's guiding us. Yeah, I know He's allowing the generation to fall, but He's eventually going to get us there. Yeah, exactly. There's intention in Moses writing this. That's absolutely right. Now it says, of course, that Lot lifted up his eyes, verse 10, and saw that the Jordan Valley was well watered everywhere, like the garden of the Lord. Like the land of Egypt in the direction of Zoar. Okay, this is south, at the south end of the Jordan Valley. Now let me remind you what we're talking about here. We're talking about this I guess you call it the right hand side, the eastern side of the land of Palestine is a river that flows almost due north and south from the Sea of Galilee in the north to the Dead Sea in the south. And it is a lush river valley. Okay, the Jordan Valley is even to this day a lush place because, of course, it's watered. So that as when you have a water source, of course, vegetation grows nicely in that area. And the Jordan has a tendency to wax and wane in terms of its size over time. And so there will be times during the rainy seasons when the Jordan is flowing like a massive river, like the Mississippi near, you know, its Louisiana outlet. And there'll be other times where it's just a little trickle running through. And so that produces this zone around it that's very lush. Now, Moses is also careful to note something. There's a parenthesis in English, modern English Bibles then, in the middle of verse 10. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So Moses is reminding his readers, the area that we're going to here, that Lot chooses to go to, is around what is now known as the Dead Sea or the Salt Sea, but in that day was a thriving freshwater lake being fed by the Jordan from the north. And this lake then was prosperous all around it. The area all around it was lush and green. There were peoples living there. There were, at this point, cities that had sprouted up in that area, Sodom and Gomorrah and others. And so Lot looks, and what does he see? He sees a terrific place. I want to go there. And I suspect, by the way, that there's already been some, we talked about this last week when we were talking about, in the questions about this, there was probably some scouts from within Abrams' group that had already gone around and looked at various areas and scouted it out. You needed the scouts, by the way, not only for discovering where to go with your herds, but also, hey, who are the natives there and what am I going to be up against if I move into that particular area? So it's very possible that Lot, you know, when it says Lot looked, lifted up his eyes, what he means is he looked upon this area from the perspective of what he knew about it and said, that's where I want to go. I want to go down there. Okay? And so Lot chooses, verse 11, chooses for himself all the Jordan Valley, and Lot journeys east. Thus they separated. So he goes, I suspect he goes straight across from Bethel to the Jordan Valley, and then he decides to continue to the south. As the Jordan flows south, it becomes more and more arid to the south. It becomes more and more lush as you go south. And so he wants to go down there. He wants to go to that territory. So he goes. That's where he goes. So it says they separated from each other. And I think that Lot made a choice on the basis, as someone said earlier, on the basis of convenience, on the basis of its potential. He said, you know, this will be a great place to raise flocks because obviously, it's lush there. I will obviously grow in my wealth because as I take my flocks there, they will multiply and I'll have more and I'll be important and so forth. But Moses wants us to know that this was a poor decision. The clear implication of this text is that this is a poor decision. A couple of reasons why. First, he has chosen to leave his patriarch, which means he's left the protection of Abram. He's choosing to walk away from the protection that Abram will give him. And our next lesson will be about Abram going and rescuing Lot from this very situation. And so Lot's choice was based on convenience, but Lot didn't think it through. And he forgot about the fact that he was walking into, he was leaving behind his police force, his guerrilla force. But it was also, of course, poor because it was solely for selfish reason, rather than deferring to Abram, his elder. The response that Lot should have had is, oh, Abram, thank you for this choice, but what would you have us to do? What would you, you're the wise one, you're the elder here, what would you have me to do? And then thirdly, of course, as Moses again points out in the text, verse 13, he's moving to a place that's known for its wickedness. That's the implication of verse 13. Now the men of Sodom were wicked, great sinners against the Lord. Moses is not only reminding his audience of that, which he probably didn't need to be reminded of it, but he wants to put the context in front of them to say Lot probably knew about the men of Sodom. He probably knew about what kind of civilization was living in that territory down there, what was going on amongst those people down there. Yet he chose it anyways. So he made a choice that was selfish, he made a choice that was short-sighted, and he made a choice that put him in not only physical danger, but spiritual danger as well. It doesn't appear that he cares. Okay. And by the way, this is the evidence. Verse 13 to me is one of the strongest evidences that this is part of Abram's testing of Lot to see if he will choose spiritually what is right. Will he turn and call upon the name of the Lord and seek what is good and what is right rather than heading to a place of sinfulness? I do think, by the way, as we were talking earlier, Wayne, about the fact that this is also valuable for the Israelites reading the book, because remember, God has instructed the Israelites, I'm going to give you this land, but watch out for the natives. Okay? And I've set up specific rules about what you can do with the natives and what you can't do with the natives. And one of the first things, you can't intermarry with them, but I'm also going to send you in to destroy them. So don't go in and start making buddy-buddy with the neighbors. Okay, your purpose in going in is not only to occupy this land, but to cleanse it from the kinds of people that are living there. Because these people have been living in great wickedness for a long time, and it's now time for my wrath to come against them, and I'm using you as an instrument to accomplish it. So Lot is a sort of a foreshadowing of that in the sense that Lot is getting chummy with the neighbors, and it's going to prove to be unwise and dangerous. Moses may be poking the Israelites and saying, see, this is what happens when you get chummy with the neighbors that live in this territory. So that's important. Now, I asked you to compare this choice on the part of Lot and the whole relationship that they had together with 1 Corinthians chapter 6. Paul, in 1 Corinthians 6, writing to a church that is, look, you read the book of Corinthians, the church at Corinth had more problems than you can shake a stick at, okay? I can tell you what, if I had discovered Corinth in my search for a church, I would have been saying, no, thank you, I don't want to go there. There's problems in this church, okay? And one of the problems that appears to be happening amongst the Corinthians is that they're actually taking each other to secular courts over matters between them. And Paul says, this is the height of stupidity, what you're doing here. He says, when one of you have a grievance against another, does he dare to go to law, which means, does he dare to go to a secular court outside of the church before the unrighteous? Now, a man who does not know Christ, a judge over a court that does not know the Lord, are you actually suggesting to me that you take your disputes that you have as believers to secular courts and asking unrighteous men to make decisions about these things? I mean, it's a rhetorical question, of course. Or do you not know that the saints will judge the world? We're going to be in positions of judging the wickedness. Why would we go and put ourselves in the hands of wicked judges? Are you not competent to try trivial cases? Do you not know that we are to judge angels? How much more then matters pertaining to this life? So if you have such cases, why do you lay them before those who have no standing in the church? I say this to your shame. All of those are rhetorical questions that Paul says you should be ashamed in answering them. He says, can it be that there's no one among you wise enough to settle the dispute between you, but brother goes to brother against brother? Brother goes to law against brother, and that before unbelievers? To have lawsuits at all with one another is already a defeat for you. Why not rather suffer wrong? Why not rather be defrauded? And what, here's the principle that Paul's laying down. Paul says, you know, sometimes in the church, it's better to be wronged than it is to try to solve it. It's better to just get hit in the face and accept it and move on. It's kind of Jesus' own principle. I think Paul is parroting. Yeah, turn the other cheek here. The fact is that there's something at stake here. And what's at stake in these matters is the gospel of Jesus Christ. What's at stake here is the message of the church. What's at stake here in the reputation of the church. If the reputation of the church suffers in the light of men, in the eyes of men in the world, you negate your message before them. You've decided to actually put the message of the church in danger when you actually fight amongst yourself in open court. These things, if you have disputes with your brothers, handle it in-house. Figure out a way to deal with it. Now, the obvious thing that you do, of course, is you go to one another and you try to work it out. You try to converse about these things and try to find common ground and try to love one another in a way of saying, look, I don't want this strife between us. I want us to have an understanding of each other. And I want us to come to some common ground. We all make mistakes. We all say stupid things. We all do things that cause our brothers to become angry with us. But our job is to protect the reputation of the church. And I think, in a sense, that's kind of what Abram is doing. Abram, the choice that Lot makes to move away when Abram is given the opportunity to make such a choice is that Abram is willing to say, I will be wronged here to allow my brother to have the first choice. And the principle comes into the New Testament gospel in a much broader sense, in a much more redemptive revelation, in that the gospel says to us, we have been forgiven by God more than we can possibly imagine. Therefore, let's be quick for us to forgive one another. Let's not let the church be ruined, its reputation be ruined before the world by allowing ourselves to be in conflict with another and letting it spill out into the world.
And unfortunately, we see a lot of it.
And we see a lot of that sort of thing.
But in the whole scope of things, all of these things are so trivial. You know,
of course. But have you ever noticed how people really hold on to the trivial? Because, you know, man, I want my, I'm right on this, doggone it, and I'm going to make sure that I cut my way. Even if that means that person over there, I'm broken with them for the rest of my life. I don't care. I'm staying right here. Abram is a picture of a man who said, you know what, I'm going to give Lot this choice. It's going to make a stupid choice. It's not going to do what's right. I should get the first choice. I'm the guy that was called by God here. I'm the one that should have the opportunity to choose. But I'm not going to do that. I'm going to let him have that first choice.
It's okay.
It's okay. And so that's the point that I think Paul is trying to make here. And I think he's trying to make it even to the Israelites. Okay? Now, back to Genesis 13 then, as Lot goes away now, you know, Lot picks up his stuff and he moves down into the valley down there, and he's living down there. Verse 14 immediately follows. The Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him. Okay, so now God says to Abram, okay, let me come back into your situation here. Lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, north and south and east and west, for all the land that you see, I will give to you and to your offspring forever. Now, don't miss the irony here. What does Abraham give Lot an opportunity to do? Pick a place, and you can go there. And God comes and taps Abraham on the shoulder and says, everywhere is yours. I'm giving you all of this land.
Think where Abraham is, elevation-wise.
He's up
high.
He can look across a wide swath of land. Yeah.
Just
spin around and look all around. You see all this? It's going to be yours. I've decided that. For all the land that you see, I will give to you and your offspring forever. So God now promises to Abram and his descendants that they would occupy this land. But there's another promise embedded in here that you mustn't overlook, and it's in verse 16. I will make your offspring as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can count the dust of the earth, your offspring would also be countable, is what that is, how that is said. I'm going to make your offspring so numerous that they're not going to be countable. It's going to be an uncountable number. It's going to be so great. Arise, walk through the length and breadth of the land, for I will give it to you. So Abram moved his tent and settled by the oaks of Mamre, which are at Hebron, and there he built an altar to the Lord. Hebron, sorry. I lived in Hebron. I always want to call it Hebron. Hebron. He goes to Hebron and to live in that place. But here's what's going on. God is giving him now the final promise, in the sense that, remember, there was a whole bunch of promises that he already got in chapter 12, right? When he first came to the land, God came to him and said, I'm going to make your name great. I'm going to make you a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. All the families of the earth will be blessed through you. And then he had also given him a land promise earlier, verse 7 of chapter 12, to your offspring I will give this land. So all that God is doing here is repeating the land promise, but he's adding to the land promise the offspring promise. So this is the promise of what's going to come from Abraham. Now there's one great promise to follow this later, of course, and that's the covenantal promise that God is going to make. But I would argue that the covenant is actually just taking all of these things, wrapping them up and completing them. So Abram is instructed to walk the land, to scout out the entirety of the land, to see it for himself, what it looked like. And God made Abram do this for a number of reasons. One, I think, is to assure Abram after Lot has left, hey, it's okay. I got your back. I'm still with you. Don't worry about it. Lot may have gone and chose that particular area, but I'm going to lead you where you need to be. And you may not be led by me into the most wonderful of places. You might go to some difficult territories. That's okay. But I'm going to take care of you. Don't worry about it. Secondly, it is a test of faith. Walk this land. Walk around. Do you believe me when I say I'm going to give you all this place? As he would have gone out from here, he would have gone to the north. As he walked towards the north, he'd be walking into the territory that Israel would occupy, what we would call the northern kingdoms would occupy, into the land of, ultimately, which would become the land of Samaria during Jesus' days. There's a lot to be seen in there. There's great forests in that territory to the north that he would have seen. As he would have gone to the west, he would have gone down into the Mediterranean Valley. He would have seen the civilizations that were living there, the Phoenicians and the Philistines, who were shipbuilding and seafaring people. He would have seen them. You know, he would have seen the seafood eating folk down in that part of the world. If he'd have gone to the south, he'd have seen desert. As he would have gone south from Ai and Bethel, he would have gone down into the territory of Judah. He would have gone down to the great expanse of territory that ultimately the Messiah would come from. If he went to the east, of course, he'd be going to the Jordan Valley. If he did cross across the Jordan Valley, he'd be going into the Transjordan area. He'd go to where the tribes of Reuben and the half-tribe of Manasseh and what was the other one? It was Simeon on the other side, I think, that occupied that territory. The Edomites and the Moabites are over there now at this time. And so, well, not the Edomites at this time, but for Moses' time, the Edomites were there. Abram would not have seen them because Esau wasn't born yet. So he would have seen all of that territory. So he would have seen a wide array of land types and peoples as he would have walked around this particular territory. It doesn't say exactly how far he went. It ultimately says that he moved his tent to the Oaks of Mamre, but I wonder if the gap between verses 16 and 17, or I'm sorry, between 17 and 18 would have been Abram, you know, taking his flocks and his family and moving around this territory. Question. Who did he take with him?
What?
Who did he take with him as he walked this earth? He took his wife.
Oh.
He took his wife. His wife gets the opportunity to see all this too. She's participating in this. It's as much a test of faith for her as it is for him. Now, she's not mentioned. But we mustn't forget, she's going to pop up in this story. She's already been in the story, right? She's going to pop up again in this story, and she's going to be tested in her faith. This isn't just about Abram's faith. This is about Sarah's faith too. This is about two people, husband and wife, that are being asked to go to this particular place and figure out what it means to trust in God and to follow after him, because this offspring promise affects her, doesn't it? Because she's the one that's going to have to bring forth the children that will become the agent of this offspring. So I think, you know, Moses was a man of his age. Obviously, he was he wasn't a very egalitarian sort of guy, you know. I mean, that's not the way the world worked in those days. But there's an undercurrent here that Sarah is a part of this whole thing. Because this offspring promise, she's going to doubt later on.
Laugh.
Yes. And so I think all of this walking around and seeing all this and God going with them and God communicating with them and Abram going and calling upon the name of the Lord at the altar, Sarah's all a part of this, all the way through this. And it's important for us to keep in mind. And I think as men, guys, those of us with wives, it's our responsibility too to keep that in mind. Our faith journey is not just ours. It's our responsibility as men to not only lead ourselves spiritually, but to lead our wives that way as well. They're on the journey with you. And this is important as we consider marriage to be a one flesh union, where God has united us with another person in a sense in which there's not two of you anymore. There's now one of you that are walking around in two parts. And you will have a common reality there. And it's important that we consider that when we consider faith matters, when we consider spiritual matters. Our job isn't just to raise ourselves in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, it's to raise our wives. Yeah, to do so with our kids too, but our wives, to bring them along on that journey. This is a great promise that God makes to Abram. Probably the single greatest promise that Abram could have been given. As a third millennium BC man, to be told by a deity that your offspring are going to be as numerous as the sands of the seashore would have been the ultimate compliment.
I got a perspective this week on dust. I don't know if you've been around a while. I remember seeing there on occasion we used to get this dust that would come from the west out of Texas. And it would put a haze in the air. It's been years since I've seen that, but I remember it as a kid. But I watched a NOAA video of this last hurricane season.
Mm-hmm. I saw that. I saw that.
I saw that.
Yep.
And dumps into the Atlantic.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
I mean, it was like.
Yep.
And this goes on year after year after year. I'm surprised it's the continent growing because there's so much dust.
I saw that. It was really fascinating to see this great swirl of dust coming through. And then you see these little hurricanes moving that dust along. It was pretty cool.
But when you see it come off the coast, at first I said, what is all that? And then I read the a key at the bottom that said what all these different colors and things were. It was dust. And I was like,
You ought to come to Kansas sometime. And actually watch a wall of dust come from the west.
I've only seen it on film.
Yeah. We were there a few years back. I didn't see it very often because the farmers have, you know, have planted trees in such a way as to prevent that sort of thing now. Because remember in the Dust Bowl days, that whole territory was wiped out by, you know, wind. But, there was one several years back where we were standing outside and you could look to the west. It was a perfectly clear day that day, but there was a wind blowing from the west, a strong wind blowing from the west coming down off the mountains, and there was a wall of dust coming.
Is that a
and it took a couple of hours for this wall to reach us, but it was massive.
Is that like a haboob? You know what that, there's something called that?
I don't know the name of it, but
there's a, I know in Arizona, I was with a guy in Arizona, and he told me about
it. Oh, yeah. You see him there, too,
It would just be, and they call it a haboob.
It's a dust storm. Yeah,
it's a dust storm.
We got caught in a dust storm outside of Flagstaff once on Interstate 40.
You're shut down.
And you couldn't drive. We literally had to pull over and wait for this thing to pass. Because
it's fascinating. But think about that. And
think
about dust and sand.
How many people is that?
Yeah.
I asked you to close your lesson last week by just recalling to your mind a promise from the New Testament that you consider to be your favorite, not a very good word, but your most impressive promise, impressing upon you the things of God. And I know there's a lot of answers to that question. There are many, many promises that God gives to us. But the one that stood out to me is the one in Romans 8, 28 to 30. Where the promise is that God works all things together for the good of those who are called by Him according to His purpose. And there's, to me, I don't think there's any New Testament promise that's really more relevant to Abram than that one. Because here's a man called by the purpose of God. He is a man who is set aside specifically. And you'll notice how that promise is worded in Romans 8. It's not just God works all things out for everybody. No, He works His promises out, His purposes out in those He calls. He has a specific purpose in calling certain individuals. He doesn't call everybody. God doesn't extend His grace to every human. He extends His grace to those He calls. He has a purpose and a name behind those He calls. And He works that promise out in them. And He works all things together. And the all things is the good and the bad. It's not all the good things. There's a lot of challenges in life that are designed by God to be used for good. Someone was asking me the other day about, what happens to babies when they die? Does God take them to heaven or does, you know, what happens to them? And I said, you know, God elects His own. He purposes His own. He knows His own. And so He will do with that child what is good, as He defines it. Not as we define it, but as He defines it. So good is not relative to our understanding, it's relative to His understanding. What does God consider good? There are people in our own congregation who are going through what I would consider to be circumstances that I couldn't handle. They're going through those things. They're struggling and suffering with those things. And the fact is that as leaders of the church and as members of the church, we feel impotent, really, to do something. We don't even know what we could possibly do. We throw ourselves on the ground and pray, but what else do we do? How do we help these people? And it's almost as though they continue to get more problems poured out on their lives. And we stand there with our mouths open like, I don't even know what to say, much less what to do. But guess what? God is working all of that out to His good. For their good, whatever that might mean in the future, but ultimately all of this is good. You know, it's hard to look at that and say, oh yeah, that's good. God's working that out for His good. and we should, you know, pat them on the shoulder and say, hey, you need to trust God. You need to, you know, you need to turn to His Word and look in faith and these sorts of things. That's hard to say because it sounds like a platitude, but it's not. It is precisely what God wants us to say in that situation. God is working these things out for your good, or more specifically, for His good. What He is trying to accomplish. I have no idea why it is that God will put you through that. And I, here's what I do know. He probably will never tell us. He has purposed that. He's doing that. He'll never explain it to us, and He doesn't have to, because He's God. What's that? We probably wouldn't understand it either way, right?
Maybe we'll get some glimpse.
Yes. We may get a bit of it. But in terms of His ever overarching, everlasting purposes, for example, why does God elect some and not others, and why me and not everybody else? I mean, you know, He's never going to explain that.
It's not faith if you got
it. But it's not faith if I have the answers. That's exactly right. And so the point is that here is a man who is called by God according to His purpose, and God says, I'm going to make your offspring as descent. You're not going to be. You're going to die. But I'll make your offspring great. And it's a matter of Abraham looking into the face of his God and saying, that is good. I don't know what the pain and struggles are going to be in my life, but that is good. And I'm going to fall back into the net of God's goodness in regards to all of the various things that happens to us. So the advice that I would give is this. Listen. Stop praying for God to remove the pain in your life. Start praying for God to give you greater strength to endure it. Because God has purposed it into your life.
I find it easier for my situations to think that way than to tell others that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's what I feel. I'm like, you know, all right, God, you got me here. I'm good. You know, we're good.
Yep.
We're going to work this out.
God's going to give me the strength to see me through this. And what I mean by strength is God's going to give me the faith to work through this, to trust Him in the midst of these things, to not abandon my belief that He is in fact in control of all things, that I can rely upon Him. I'm to be wise, which means I need to call upon Him to seek His advice on what to do and where to do it and how to do it, and not to make further stupid mistakes that might have gotten me into this particular situation. You know how that is. So the fact is that we are being called by God to be people of faith. We're not being called by God to be people with all the answers. And so we gather together on a regular basis in the church to sharpen one another.
To be satisfied in Christ.
To be satisfied in knowing that, and this is the way that I put it. You hear me pray this way very often. Lord, help us to look through our troubles to see Christ sitting upon His throne, high and mighty and lifted up. And these matters become trivial against that picture that I see. Let me look through them, not around them. Let me look through them to see Christ. And let me walk through them, even if I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. So what? The Lord is with me, nonetheless. So this is a great promise that God makes to Abram, a tremendous promise that God makes to him. And it is the beginnings, of course, of the ultimate promise God brings in Christ. He's fulfilling that great promise. He started back with Adam and Eve, and now here comes the people. And remember, the people that are reading the book are the dust. They're the dust. So God has, in fact, done a great thing. He kept a promise to Abram. They're reading it, and they're saying, we're the promise. We're the result of the promise. What do you think that's designed to say to them?
Yeah,
keep your eyes fixed upon Him. He's faithful. He does what He promises. So when you go into this land and you have to face the giants, face them, trusting in Him.